content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello and happy holidays from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm George Douglas, and I am delighted to read to you a wonderful Christmas holiday book entitled The Best Christmas Pageant Ever by Barbara Robinson. It's about a wild and crazy group of children, the Herdmans, who find the true meaning of Christmas for themselves and, quite surprisingly, for everyone else in their town as well. I would like to read this wonderful story in memorial and in tribute to my good friends Dr. Peter Stein and his wife Betsy. Peter introduced this story to thousands of children and adults in a unique one-man show. He did the show in his hometown of Danvers, Massachusetts, and beyond, even Chapel Hill, North Carolina. For Peter and Betsy, and all of their children and grandchildren, I am delighted to present The Best Christmas Pageant Ever. Chapter 1. The Herdmans were absolutely the worst kids in the history of the world. They lied and stole and smoked cigars, even the girls, and talked dirty and hit little kids and cussed their teachers and took the name of the Lord in vain and set fire to Fred Shoemaker's old broken-down tool house. The tool house burned right down to the ground, and I think that surprised the Herdmans. They set fire to things all the time. But that was the first time they managed to burn down a whole building. I guess it was an accident. I don't suppose they woke up that morning and said to one another, "Let's go burn down Fred Shoemaker's tool house." But maybe they did. After all, it was a Saturday and not much was going on. It was a terrific fire, 2 engines and 2 police cars, and all the volunteer firemen and 5 dozen donuts sent up by the Tasty Lunch Diner. The donuts were supposed to be for the firemen, but by the time they got the fire out, the donuts were all gone. The Herdmans got them. What they couldn't eat, they stuffed in their pockets and down the front of their shirts. You could actually see the donuts all around Ollie Herdman's middle. I couldn't understand why the Herdmans were hanging around the scene of their crime. Everybody knew the whole thing was their fault, and you'd think they'd have the brains to get out of sight. One fireman even collared Claude Herdman and said, "Did you kids start this fire, smoking cigars in that tool house?" But Claude just said, "We weren't smoking cigars." And they weren't. They were playing with Leroy Herdman's Young Einstein chemistry set, which he stole from the hardware store, and that was how they started the fire. Leroy said so. "We mixed all the little powders together," he said, "and poured lighter fluid around them and set fire to the lighter fluid. We wanted to see if the chemistry set was any good." Any other kid, even a mean kid, would have been a little bit worried if he stole $4.95 worth of something and then burned down a building with it. But Leroy was just mad because the chemistry set got burned up along with everything else before he had a chance to make 1 or 2 bombs. The fire chief got us all together. There were 15 or 20 kids standing around watching the fire, and gave us a little talk about playing with matches and gasoline and dangerous things like that. "I don't say that's what happened here," he told us. "I don't know what happened here, but that could have been it, and you see the result. So let this be a good lesson to you boys and girls." Of course, it was a great lesson to the Herdmans. They learned that wherever there's a fire, there will be free donuts sooner or later. I guess things would have been different if they'd burned down, say, the Second Presbyterian Church instead of the tool house, but the tool house was about to fall down anyway. All the neighbors had pestered Mr. Shoemaker to do something about it because it looked so awful and was sure to bring rats. So everybody said the fire was a blessing in disguise, and even Mr. Shoemaker said it was a relief. My father said it was the only good thing the Herdmans ever did, and if they'd known it was a good thing, they wouldn't have done it at all. They would have set fire to something else, or somebody. They were just so all around awful, you could hardly believe they were real. Ralph, Imogene, Leroy, Claude, Ollie, and Gladys. Six skinny, stringy-haired kids, all alike except for being different sizes and having different black and blue places where they had clonked each other. They lived over a garage at the bottom of Sproul Hill. Nobody used the garage anymore, but the Herdmans used to bang the door up and down just as fast as they could and try to squash one another. That was their idea of a game. Where other people had grass in their front yard, the Herdmans had rocks. And where other people had hydrangea bushes, the Herdmans had poison ivy. There was also a sign in the yard that said, "Beware of the cat." New kids always laughed about that till they got a look at the cat. It was the meanest-looking animal I ever saw. It had one short leg and a broken tail and one missing eye. And the mailman wouldn't deliver anything to the Herdmans because of it. "I don't think it's a regular cat at all," the mailman told my father. "I think those kids went up in the hills and caught themselves a bobcat." "Oh, I don't think you can tame a wild bobcat," my father said. "I'm sure you can't," said the mailman. "They never try to tame it. They just try to make it wilder than it was to begin with." If that was in their plan, it worked. The cat would attack anything he could see out of its one eye. One day, Claude Herdman emptied the whole first grade in 3 minutes flat when he took the cat to show and tell. He didn't feed it for 2 days, so it was already mad, and then he carried it to school in a box. And when he opened the box, the cat shot out right straight up in the air, people said. It came down on the top blackboard ledge and clawed four big long scratches all the way down the blackboard. Then it just tore around all over the place, scratching little kids and shedding fur and scattering books and papers everywhere. The teacher, Miss Brandell, yelled for everybody to run out in the hall, and she pulled a coat over her head and grabbed a broom and tried to corner the cat. But, of course, she couldn't see with the coat over her head, so she just ran up and down the aisles hollering, "Here, kitty," and smacking the broom down wherever the cat hissed back. She knocked over the Happy Family dollhouse and a globe of the world, and broke the aquarium full of 20 gallons of water and about 65 goldfish. All the time she kept yelling for Claude to come and catch his cat, but Claude had gone out in the hall with the rest of the class. Later, when Miss Brandell was slapping Band-Aids on everyone who could show her any blood at all, she asked Claude why in the world he didn't come and get his cat under control. "You told us to go out in the hall," Claude said, just as if he were the ordinary kind of first grader who did whatever teacher said to do. The cat settled down a little bit once it got something to eat. Most of the goldfish and Ramona Billion's two pet mice that she brought to show and tell. Ramona cried and carried on so. "I can't even bury them," she said, that they sent her home. The room was a wreck, broken glass and papers and books and puddles of water and dead goldfish everywhere. Miss Brandell was sort of a wreck, too, and most of the first graders were hysterical, so somebody took them outdoors and let them have recess for the rest of the day. Claude took the cat home, and after there was a rule that, you couldn't bring anything alive to show and tell. The Herdmans moved from grade to grade through the Woodrow Wilson School like those South American fish that strip your bones clean in 3 minutes flat, which was just about what they did to one teacher after another. But they never, never got kept back in a grade. When it came time for Claude Herdman to pass to the second grade, he didn't know his ABCs, or his numbers, or his colors, or his shapes, or his three bears, or how to get along with anybody, but Miss Brandell passed him anyway. For one thing, she knew she'd have Ollie Herdman the next year. That was the thing about the herdmans. There was always another one coming along, and no teacher was crazy enough to let herself in for two of them at one time. I was always in the same grade with Imogene Herdman, and what I did was stay out of her way. It wasn't easy to stay out of her way. You couldn't do it if you were very pretty or very ugly or very smart or very dumb or had anything unusual about you, like red hair or double-jointed thumbs. But if you were sort of a medium kid like me and kept your mouth shut when the teacher said, "Who can name all 50 states?" you had a pretty good chance to stay clear of Imogene. As far as anyone could tell, Imogene was just like the rest of the Herdmans. She never learned anything either, except dirty words and secrets about everybody. Twice a year, we had to go to the health room to get weighed and measured, and Imogene always managed to find out exactly what everybody weighed. Sometimes she would hang around waiting for the nurse, Miss Hemphill, to give her a Band-Aid. Sometimes she would sneak behind the curtain where they kept a folding cot and just stay there the whole time with one eye on the scales. "Why are you still here, Imogene?" Miss Hemphill asked one day. "You can go back to your room." "I think you better look and see if I've got what Ollie has." "Well, what does Ollie have?" Imogene shrugged. "We don't know. Red spots all over." Miss Hemphill looked at her. "What did the doctor say?" "We didn't have a doctor," Imogene began scrunching her back up and down against the medicine cabinet. "Well, does Ollie have a fever? Is he in bed?" "No, he's in the first grade." "Right now?" Miss Hemphill stared. "Why, he shouldn't be in school with red spots. It could be measles or chicken pox, any number of things, contagious things. What are you doing?" "Scratching my back," Imogene said. "Boy, do I itch." "The rest of you boys and girls go back to your classroom," Miss Hemphill said, "and Imogene, you stay right here." So we all went back to our room, and Miss Hemphill went to the first grade to look at Ollie, and Imogene stayed in the health room and copied down everybody's weight from Miss Hemphill's records. "Your weight was supposed to be a big secret, like what you got on your report card." "It's nobody's business what you get on your report card," all the teacher said, and Miss Hemphill said the same thing. "It's nobody's business what you weigh." Not even the fat kids could find out what they weighed, but Imogene always knew. "Don't let Albert Pelfrey on the swing," she would yell at recess. "He'll bust it." Albert Pelfrey weighs 143 pounds. Last time he weighed 137. So right away, everybody knew two things about Albert. We knew exactly how fat he was, and we also knew that he was getting fatter all the time. "You have to go to fat camp this summer," Imogene hollered at him. "Miss Hemphill wrote it down on your paper." Fat camp is a place where they feed you lettuce and grapefruit and cottage cheese and eggs for a month, and you either give up and cheat or give up and get skinny. "I am not," Albert said. "I'm going to Disneyland with my Uncle Frank." "That's what you think," Imogene told him. Albert had to believe her. She was always right about things like that. So all year he had fat camp to look forward to instead of Disneyland. Sometimes Imogene would blackmail the fat kids if they had anything she wanted, like Wanda Pierce's charm bracelet. Wanda Pierce weighed about a ton. She even had fat eyes, and her hobby was this charm bracelet. It had 22 charms, and every single one did something. The little wheels turned, or the little bitty piano keys went plink, or the little tiny drawers opened and closed. Besides being a fat kid, Wanda was also a rich kid, so every time you turned around, she had a new charm. "Look at my new charm," she would say. "It costs $6.95 without the tax. It's a bird, and when you push this little knob, its wings flutter. It costs $6.95. They were great charms, but everybody got sick of hearing about them, so it was almost a relief when Imogene blackmailed her out of it. "I know how much you weigh, Wanda," Imogene told her. "I wrote it down on this piece of paper. See?" It must have been an awful moment, because even Wanda looked horrified. So Imogene got her charm bracelet, and she got Lucille Golden's imitation alligator pocketbook with "Souvenir of Florida" written on it. For a while, she got 10 cents a week from Floyd Brush, till Floyd caught double pneumonia and lost 15 pounds, and then he didn't care anymore. My friend Alice Wendelkin was so nasty clean that she had detergent hands by the time she was 4 years old. Just the same, Alice picked up a case of head lice when she was at summer camp, and somehow Imogene found out about that. She would sneak up on Alice at recess and holler, "Cooties!" and smack Alice's head. She nearly knocked Alice cross-eyed before one of the teachers saw her and took both of them in to the principal. "Now, what's this all about?" the principal wanted to know, but Alice wouldn't say. "I had to hit her," Imogene told him. "She's got cooties, and I saw one crawling in her hair, and I don't want them on me." "You did not see one," Alice said. "I don't have them anymore." "What do you mean you don't have them anymore?" the principal said. "Did you have them lately?" It really shook him up. He didn't want a whole school full of kids with cooties, so he sent Alice to the health room, and the nurse went all through her head with a fine-tooth comb and a magnifying glass and finally said it was all right. But it was too late. Everybody called Alice cooties the whole rest of the year. If Imogene didn't know a secret about a person, she would make one up. She would catch you in the girls' room or out in the hall and whisper, "I know what you did." And then you'd go crazy trying to figure out what it was you did that Imogene knew about. It was no good trying to get secrets on the Herdmans. Everybody already knew about the awful things they did. You couldn't even tease them about their parents or holler, "Your father's in jail," because they didn't care. Actually, they didn't know what their father was, or where he was, or anything about him. Because when Gladys was 2 years old, he climbed on a railroad train and disappeared. Nobody blamed him. Now and then you'd see Mrs. Herdman walking the cat on a length of chain around the block, but she worked double shifts at the shoe factory and wasn't home much. My mother's friend, Miss Phillips, was a social service worker, and she tried to get some welfare money for the Herdmans so Mrs. Herdman could just work one shift and spend more time with her children. But Mrs. Herdman wouldn't do it. She liked the work, she said. "It's not the work," Miss Phillips told my mother, "and it's not the money. It's just that she'd rather be at the shoe factory than shut up at home with that crowd of kids," she sighed. I can't say I blame her. So the Herdmans pretty much looked after themselves. Ralph looked after Imogene, and Imogene looked after Leroy, and Leroy looked after Claude, and so on down the line. The Herdmans were like most big families. The big ones taught the little ones everything they knew, and the proof of that was that the meanest Herdman of all was Gladys, the youngest. We figured they were headed straight for hell by the way of the state penitentiary, until they got themselves mixed up with the church, and my mother, and our Christmas pageant. Chapter 2. Mother didn't expect to have anything to do with the Christmas pageant except to make me and my little brother Charlie be in it. We didn't want to. And to make my father go and see it. He didn't want to. Every year he said the same thing. "I've seen the Christmas pageant." "You haven't seen this year's Christmas pageant," Mother would tell him. "Charlie is a shepherd this year." "Charlie was a shepherd last year." "No, you go on and go. I'm just going to put on my bathrobe and sit by the fire and relax. There's never anything different about the Christmas pageant." "There's something different this year," Mother said. "What?" "Charlie is wearing your bathrobe." So that year my father went to see his bathrobe, he said. Actually, he went every year, but it was always a struggle, and Mother said that was her contribution to the Christmas pageant, getting my father to go to it. But then she got stuck with the whole thing when Mrs. George Armstrong fell and broke her leg. We knew about this as soon as it happened because Mrs. Armstrong only lived a block and a half away. We heard the siren and saw the ambulance and watched the policeman carry her out of the house on a stretcher. "Call Mr. Armstrong at his work," she yelled at the policeman. "Shut off the stove under my potatoes. Inform the ladies' aide that I won't be at the meeting." One of the neighbor women called out, "Helen, are you in much pain?" And Mrs. Armstrong yelled back, "Yes, terrible. Don't let those children tear up my privet hedge." Even in pain, Mrs. Armstrong could still give orders. She was so good at giving orders that she was just naturally the head of anything she belonged to, and at church she did everything but preach. Most of all, she ran the Christmas pageant every year. And here she was, 2 weeks before Thanksgiving, flat on her back. "I don't know what they'll do now about the pageant," Mother said. But the pageant wasn't the only problem. Mrs. Armstrong was also chairman of the Ladies' Aid Bazaar and coordinator of the Women's Society Potluck Supper. And there was a lot of telephoning back and forth to see who would take over those jobs. Mother had a list of names, and while she was calling people about the Ladies' Aid Bazaar, Mrs. Homer McCarthy was trying to call Mother about the potluck supper. But Mrs. McCarthy got somebody else to do that, and Mother got somebody else to do the bazaar. So the only thing left was the Christmas pageant. And Mother got stuck with that. "I could run the potluck supper with one hand tied behind my back," Mother told us. "All you have to do is make sure everybody doesn't bring meatloaf." But the Christmas pageant? Our Christmas pageant isn't what you'd call four-star entertainment. Mrs. Armstrong breaking her leg was the only unexpected thing that ever happened to it. The script is standard. The inn, the stable, the shepherds, the star, and so are the costumes, and so is the casting. Primary kids are angels. Intermediate kids are shepherds. Big boys are wise men. Elmer Hopkins, the minister's son, has been Joseph for as long as I can remember. And my friend Alice Wendelken is Mary, because she's so smart, so neat and clean, and most of all, so holy-looking. All the rest of us are the angel choir, lined up according to height, because nobody can sing parts. As a matter of fact, nobody can sing. We're strictly a no-talent outfit, except for a girl named Alberta Bottles, who whistles. Last year, Alberta whistled, "What Child Is This?" for a change of pace, but nobody liked it, especially Mrs. Bottles, because Alberta put too much into it and ran out of air and passed out cold on the manger in the middle of the third verse. Aside from that, though, it's always just the Christmas story, year after year, with people shuffling around in bathrobes and bedsheets and sharp wings. "Well," my father said, once Mother got put in charge of it, "here's your big chance. Why don't you cancel the pageant and show movies?" "Movies of what?" Mother said. "I don't know. Fred Stamper has 5 big reels of Yellowstone National Park." "What does Yellowstone National Park have to do with Christmas?" Mother asked. "I know a good movie," Charlie said. "We had it at school. It shows a heart operation, and 2 kids got sick." "Never mind," said Mother. "I guess you all think you're pretty funny, but the Christmas pageant is a tradition, and I don't plan to do anything different." Of course, nobody even thought about the Herdmans in connection with the Christmas pageant. Most of us spent all week in school being pounded and poked and pushed around by Herdmans, and we look forward to Sunday as a real day of rest. Once a month, the whole Sunday school would go to church for the first 15 minutes of the service and do something special, sing a song or act out a parable or recite Bible verses. Usually, the little kids sang, "Jesus Loves Me," which was all they were up to. But when my brother Charlie was in with the little kids, his teacher thought up something different to do. She had everybody write down on a piece of paper what they liked best about Sunday school, or draw a picture of what they liked best. And when we all got in the church, she stood up in front of the congregation and said, "Today, some of our youngest boys and girls are going to tell you what Sunday school means to them. Betsy, would you have what is on your paper and like to tell us about it?" Betsy Cathcart stood up and said, "What I like best about Sunday school is the good feeling I get when I go there." I don't think she wrote that down at all, but it sounded terrific, of course. One kid said he liked hearing all the Bible stories. Another kid said, "I like learning songs about Jesus." 8 or 9 little kids stood up and said what they liked, and it was always something good about Jesus or God or cheerful friends or a nice teacher. Finally, the teacher said, "I think we have time for one more. Charlie, what can you tell us about Sunday school?" My little brother Charlie stood up, and he didn't even have to look at his piece of paper. "What I like best about Sunday school," he said, "is that there aren't any Herdmans here." Well, the teacher should have stuck with "Jesus Loves Me," because everybody forgot all the nice churchy things the other kid said and just remembered what Charlie said about the Herdmans. When we went to pick him up after church, his teacher told us, "I'm sure there are many things that Charlie likes about Sunday school. Maybe he will tell you what some of them are." She smiled at all of us, but you could tell she was really mad. On the way home, I asked Charlie, "What are some of the other things you like that she was talking about?" He shrugged. "I like all the other stuff, but she said to write down what we like best. And what I like best is no Herdmans." "Not a very Christian sentiment," my father said. "Maybe not, but it's a very practical one," Mother told him. Last year, Charlie had spent the whole second grade being black and blue because he had to sit next to Leroy Herdman. In the end, it was Charlie's fault that the Herdman showed up in church. For 3 days in a row, Leroy Herdman stole the dessert from Charlie's lunchbox, and finally Charlie just gave up trying to do anything about it. "Oh, go and take it," he said. "I don't care. I get all the dessert I want in Sunday school." Well, Leroy wanted to know more about that. "What kind of dessert?" he said. "Chocolate cake," Charlie told him, "and candy bars and cookies and Kool-Aid. We get refreshments all the time, all we want." "You're a liar," Leroy said. Leroy was right. We got jelly beans at Easter and punch and cookies on Children's Day, and that was it. "We get ice cream, too," Charlie went on, "and donuts and popcorn balls." "Who gives it to you?" Leroy wanted to know. "The minister," Charlie said. He didn't know what else to say. Of course, that was the wrong thing to tell the Herdmans if you wanted them to stay away. And sure enough, the very next Sunday, there they were, slouching into Sunday school, eyes peeled for the refreshments. "Where do you get the cake?" Ralph asked the Sunday school superintendent, and Mr. Grady said, "Well, son, I don't know about any cake, but they're collecting the food packages out in the kitchen." What he meant was the canned stuff we brought in every year as a Thanksgiving present for the orphans' home. It was just our bad luck that the Herdmans picked that Sunday to come, because when they saw all the cans of spaghetti and beans and grape drink and peanut butter, they figured there might be some truth to what Charlie said about refreshments. So they stayed. They didn't sing any hymns or say any prayers, but they did make a little money, because I saw Imogene snake a handful of coins out of the collection basket when it went past her. At the end of the morning, Mr. Grady came to every class and made an announcement. "We'll be starting rehearsals soon for our Christmas pageant," he said, "and next week after the service we'll all gather in the back of the church to decide who will play the main roles." But of course we want every boy and girl in our Sunday school to take part in the pageant, so be sure your parents know that you'll be staying a little later next Sunday. Mr. Grady made the same speech every year, so he didn't get any wild applause. Besides, as I said, we all knew what part we were going to play anyway. Alice Wendelken must have been a little bit worried, though, because she turned around to me with a sticky smile on her face and said, "I hope you're going to be in the angel choir again. You're so good in the angel choir." What she meant was, "I hope you won't get to be married just because your mother's running the pageant." She didn't have to worry. I didn't want to be Mary. I didn't want to be in the angel choir either, but everybody had to be something. All of a sudden, Imogene Herdman dug me in the ribs with her elbow. She has the sharpest elbows of anybody I ever knew. "What's the pageant?" she said. "It's a play," I said, and for the first time that day, except when she saw the collection basket, Imogene looked interested. All the Herdmans are big moviegoers, though they never pay their own way. One or two of them start a fight at the box office of the theater while the others slip in. They get their popcorn the same way, and then they spread out all over the place so the manager can never find them all before the picture's over. "What's the play about?" Imogene asked. "It's about Jesus," I said. "Everything here is," she muttered, so I figured Imogene didn't care much about the Christmas pageant. But I was wrong. Chapter 3. Mrs. Armstrong, who was still trying to run things from her hospital bed, said that the same people always got the main parts. "But it's important to give everybody a chance," she told Mother over the telephone. "Let me tell you what I do." Mother sighed and turned off the heat under the pork chops. "All right, Helen," she said. Mrs. Armstrong called Mother at least every other day, and she always called at supper time. "Don't let me interrupt your supper," she always said, and then went right ahead and did it anyway, while my father paced up and down the hall saying things under his breath about Mrs. Armstrong. "Here's what I do," Mrs. Armstrong said. "I get them all together and tell them about the rehearsals, and that they must be on time and pay close attention. Then I tell them that the main parts are Mary and Joseph and the wise men and the angel of the Lord. And then I always remind them that there are no small parts, only small actors." "Do they understand what that means?" Mother asked. "Oh, yes," Mrs. Armstrong said. Later, Mother asked me if I knew what that meant, about small parts and small actors. I didn't really know. None of us did. It was just something Mrs. Armstrong always said. "I guess it means that the short kids have to be in the front row of the angel choir, or else nobody can see them." "I thought so," Mother said. "It doesn't mean that at all. It really means that every single person in the pageant is just as important as every other person, that the littlest baby angel is just as important as Mary." "Go and tell that to Alice Wendelken," I said, and Mother told me not to be so fresh. She didn't get very mad, though, because she knew I was right. "You could have a Christmas pageant without any baby angels, but you couldn't have one without a Mary." Mrs. Armstrong knew it, too. "I always start with Mary," she told Mother over the telephone. "I tell them that we must choose our Mary carefully because Mary was the mother of Jesus." "I know that," Mother said, wanting to get off the telephone and cook the pork chops. "Yes, I tell them that our Mary should be a cheerful, happy little girl who is unselfish and kind to others. Then I tell them about Joseph, that he was God's choice to be Jesus' father, and our Joseph ought to be a little boy." She went on, and got as far as the second wise man when Mother said, "Helen, I have to go now. There's somebody at the door." Actually, there was somebody at the door. It was my father, standing out on the porch in his coat and hat, leaning on the doorbell. When Mother let him in, he took off his hat and bowed to her. "Lady, can you give me some supper? I haven't had a square meal in 3 days." "Oh, for goodness sake," Mother said. "Come on in. What will the neighbors think to see you standing out there ringing your own doorbell? And why didn't you ring the doorbell 10 minutes ago?" Mrs. Armstrong called Mother 2 more times that week to tell her that people could hem up costumes but couldn't cut them, and to tell her not to let the angel choir wear lipstick. and by Sunday, Mother was already sick of the whole thing. After church, we all filed into the back seven pews, along with two or three Sunday school teachers who were supposed to keep everybody quiet. It was a terrible time to try to keep everybody quiet. All the little kids were tired, and all the big kids were hungry, and all the mothers wanted to go home and cook dinner, and all the fathers wanted to go home and watch the football game on TV. "Now, this isn't going to take very long," Mother told us. My father had said it better not take very long because he wanted to watch the football game, too. He also wanted to eat. He said he hadn't had a decent meal all week. "First, I'm going to tell you about the rehearsals," Mother said. "We'll have our rehearsals on Wednesdays at 6:30. We're only going to have five rehearsals, so you must all try to be present at every one." "What if we get sick?" asked a little kid in the front pew. "You won't get sick," Mother told him, which was exactly what she told Charlie that morning when Charlie said he didn't want to be a shepherd and would be sick to his stomach if she made him be one. "Now, you little children in the cradle room in the primary class will be our angels," Mother said. "You'll like that, won't you?" They all said yes. What else could they say? "The older boys and girls will be shepherds and guests at the inn and members of the choir." Mother was really zipping along, and I thought how mad Mrs. Armstrong would be about all the things she was leaving out. "And we need Mary and Joseph, the three wise men, and the angel of the Lord. They aren't hard parts, but they're very important parts, so those people must absolutely come to every rehearsal." "What if they get sick?" It was the same little kid, and it made you wonder what kind of little kid he was to be so interested in sickness. "They won't get sick either," Mother said, looking a little cross. "Now we all know what kind of person Mary was. She was quiet and gentle and kind, and the little girl who plays Mary should try to be that kind of person. I know that many of you would like to be Mary in our pageant, but of course we can only have one Mary, so I'll ask for volunteers. And then we'll all decide together which girl should get the part." That was pretty safe to say, since the only person who ever raised her hand was Alice Wendelken. But Alice just sat there, chewing on a piece of her hair and looking down at the floor. And the only person who raised her hand this time was Imogen Herdman. "Did you have a question, Imogen?" Mother asked. I guess that was the only reason she could think of for Imogen to have her hand up. "No," Imogen said. "I want to be Mary." She looked back over her shoulder. "And Ralph wants to be Joseph." "Yeah," Ralph said. Mother just stared at them. It was like a detective movie when the nice little old gray-haired lady sticks a gum in the bank window and says, "Give me all your money," and you can't believe it. Mother couldn't believe this. "Well," she said after a minute, "we want to be sure that everyone has a chance. Does anyone else want to volunteer for Joseph?" No one did. No one ever did, especially not Elmer Hopkins. But he couldn't do anything about it because he was the minister's son. One year, he didn't volunteer to be Joseph, and neither did anyone else. And afterwards, I heard Reverend Hopkins talking to Elmer out in the hall. "You're going to be Joseph," Reverend Hopkins said. "That's it." "I don't want to be Joseph," Elmer told him. "I'm too big and I feel dumb up there, and all those little kids give me a pain in the neck." "I can understand that," Reverend Hopkins said. "I can even sympathize, but till somebody else volunteers for Joseph, you're stuck with it." "Nobody's ever going to do that," Elmer said. "I even offered Grady Baker 50 cents to be Joseph, and he wouldn't do it. I'm going to have to be Joseph for the rest of my life." "Cheer up," Reverend Hopkins told him. "Maybe somebody will turn up." I'll bet he didn't think the somebody would be Ralph Herdman. "All right," Mother said. "Ralph will be our Joseph. Now, does anyone else want to volunteer for Mary?" Mother looked all around, trying to catch somebody's eye, anybody's eye. "Janet? Roberta? Alice, don't you want to volunteer this year?" "No," Alice said. so low you could hardly hear her. I don't want to. Nobody volunteered to be wise men either, except Leroy, Claude, and Ollie Herdman. So there was my mother, stuck with a Christmas pageant full of Herdmans in the main roles. There was one Herdman left over and one main role left over, and you didn't have to be very smart to figure out that Gladys was going to be the angel of the Lord. What do I have to do? Gladys wanted to know. The angel of the Lord was the one who brought the good news to the shepherds, Mother said. Right away, all the shepherds began to wiggle around in their seats, figuring that any good news Gladys brought them would come with a smack in the teeth. Charlie's friend, Hobie Carmichael, raised his hand and said, I can't be a shepherd. We're going to Philadelphia. Why didn't you say so before? Mother asked. I forgot. Another kid said, My mother doesn't want me to be a shepherd. Why not? Mother said. I don't know. She just said, don't be a shepherd. One kid was honest. Gladys Herdman hits too hard, he said. Why, Gladys isn't going to hit anybody, Mother said. What an idea. The angel just visits the shepherds in the fields and tells them that Jesus is born. And hits them, said the kid. Of course, he was right. You could just picture Gladys whamming shepherds left and right, but Mother said that was perfectly ridiculous. I don't want to hear another word about it, she said. No shepherds may quit or get sick, she added, before the kid in the front pew could ask. While everybody was leaving, Mother grabbed Alice Wendelken by the arm and said, Alice, why in the world didn't you raise your hand to be Mary? I don't know, Alice said, looking mad. But I knew. I'd heard Imogene Herdman telling Alice what would happen to her if she dared to volunteer. All the ordinary, everyday Herdman things, like clonking you on the head and drawing pictures all over your homework papers and putting worms in your coat pocket. I don't care, Alice told her. I don't care what you do. I'm always Mary in the pageant. And next spring, Imogene went on, squinching up her eyes, when the pussy willows come out, I'll stick a pussy willow so far down your ear that nobody can reach it, and it'll sprout there, and it'll grow and grow, and you'll spend the rest of your life with a pussy willow bush growing out of your ear. You had to admire her. That was the worst thing any of them ever thought up to do. Of course, some people might not think that could happen, but it could. Ollie Herdman did it once. He got this terrible earache in school, and when the nurse looked down his ear with her little lighted tube, she yelled so loud you could hear her all the way down the hall. He's got something growing down there, she hollered. They had to take Ollie to the hospital and put him under and dig the sprouted pussy willow out of his ear. So that was why Alice kept her mouth shut about being Mary. You know she wouldn't do all those things she said, I told Alice as we walked home. Yes, she would, Alice said. Herdmans will do anything. But your mother should have told them no. Somebody should put Imogene out of the pageant, and all the rest of them, too. They'll do something terrible, and they'll ruin the whole thing. I thought she was probably right, and so did lots of other people. And for 2 or 3 days, all anybody could talk about was the Herdmans being Mary and Joseph and all. Mrs. Homer McCarthy called Mother to say that she had been thinking and thinking about it, and if the Herdmans wanted to participate in our Christmas celebration, why didn't we let them hand out programs at the door? We don't have any programs for the Christmas pageant, Mother said. Well, maybe we ought to get some printed and put the Herdmans in charge of that. Alice's mother told the lady's aide that it was sacrilegious to let Imogene Herdman be Mary. Somebody we never heard of called up Mother on the telephone and said her name was Hazelbeck and she lived on Sproul Hill. And was it true that Imogene Herdman was going to be Mary, the mother of Jesus, in a church play? Yes, Mother said. Imogene is going to be Mary in our Christmas pageant. And the rest of them, too? The lady asked. Yes. Ralph is going to be Joseph, and the others are the wise men and the angel of the Lord. You must be crazy, this Mrs. Hazelbeck told Mother. I live next door to that outfit with their yelling and screaming and their insane cat and their garage door going up and down all day long. And let me tell you, you're in for one rowdy time. Some people said it wasn't fair for a whole family who didn't even go to our church to barge in and take over the pageant. My father said somebody better lock up the Women's Society Silver Service. My mother just said she would rather be in the hospital with Mrs. Armstrong. But then the flower committee took a potted geranium to Mrs. Armstrong and told her what was going on, and she nearly fell out of bed, traction bars and all. "I feel personally responsible," she said. "Whatever happens, I accept the blame. If I'd been up and around and doing my duty, this never would have happened." And that made my mother so mad she couldn't see straight. "If she'd been up and around, it wouldn't have happened," Mother said. "That woman! She must be surprised that the sun is still coming up every morning without her to supervise the sunrise." "Well, let me tell you..." "Don't tell me," my father said. "I'm on your side. I just mean that Helen Armstrong is not the only woman alive who can run a Christmas pageant. Up till now, I'd made up my mind just to do the best I could under the circumstances, but now..." She stabbed a meat fork into the pot roast. "I'm going to make this the very best Christmas pageant anybody ever saw, and I'm going to do it with Herdman's, too. After all, they raised their hands and nobody else did, and that's that." And it was, too. For one thing, nobody else wanted to take over the pageant, with or without Herdman's, and for another thing, Reverend Hopkins got fed up with all the complaints and told everybody where to get off. Of course, he didn't say, "Go jump in the lake, Mrs. Wendelken," or anything like that. He just reminded everyone that when Jesus said, "Suffer the little children to come unto me," Jesus meant all the little children, including Herdman's. So that shut everybody up, even Alice's mother, and the next Wednesday, we started rehearsals. Chapter 4. The first pageant rehearsal was usually about as much fun as a 3-hour ride on the school bus and just as noisy and crowded. This rehearsal, though, was different. Everybody shut up and settled down right away for fear of missing something awful that the Herdmans might do. They got there 10 minutes late, sliding into the room like a bunch of outlaws about to shoot up a saloon. When Leroy passed Charlie, he knuckled him behind the ear, and one little primary girl yelled as Gladys went by. But Mother had said she was going to ignore everything except blood, and since the primary kid wasn't bleeding, and neither was Charlie, nothing happened. Mother said, "And here's the Herdman family. We're glad to see you all," which was probably the biggest lie ever said right out loud in church. Imogene smiled, the Herdman smile. We called it sly and sneaky. And there they sat, the closest thing to criminals that we knew about, and they were going to represent the best and most beautiful. No wonder everybody was so worked up. Mother started to separate everyone into angels and shepherds and guests at the end, but right away she ran into trouble. Who were the shepherds? Leroy Herdman wanted to know. Where did they come from? Ollie Herdman didn't even know what a shepherd was, or anyway, that's what he said. What was the inn? Claude asked. What's an inn? It's like a motel, somebody told him, where people go to spend the night. What people? Claude said. Jesus? Oh, honestly, Alice Wendelken grumbled. Jesus wasn't even born yet. Mary and Joseph went there. Why? Ralph asked. What happened first? Imogene hollered at my mother. Begin at the beginning. That really scared me, because the beginning would be the book of Genesis, where it says in the beginning, and if we were going to have to start with the book of Genesis, we would never get through. The thing was, the Herdmans didn't know anything about the Christmas story. They knew that Christmas was Jesus' birthday, but everything else was news to them. The shepherds, the wise men, the star, the stable, the crowded inn. It was hard to believe. At least it was hard for me to believe. Alice Wendelken said she didn't have any trouble believing it. How would they find out about the Christmas story, she said. They don't even know what a Bible is. Look what Gladys did to that Bible last week. While Imogene was snitching money from the collection plate in my class, Gladys and Ollie drew mustaches and tails on all the disciples in the primary grade illustrated Bible. They never went to church in their whole life till your little brother told them we got refreshments, Alice said. And all you ever hear about Christmas in school is about how to make ornaments out of aluminum foil. So how would they know about the Christmas story? She was right. Of course, they might have read about it, but they never read anything except Amazing Comics. And they might have heard about it on TV, except that Ralph paid 65 cents for their TV at a garage sale, and you couldn't see anything on it unless somebody held on to the antenna. Even then, you couldn't see much. The only other way for them to hear about the Christmas story was from their parents, and I guess Mr. Herdman never got around to it before he climbed on the railroad train. And it was pretty clear that Mrs. Herdman had given up ever trying to tell them anything. So they just didn't know. And Mother said she had better begin by reading the Christmas story from the Bible. This was a pain in the neck to most of us, because we knew the whole thing backward and forward and never had to be told anything except who we were supposed to be and where we were supposed to stand. Joseph and Mary, his espoused wife, being great with child. Pregnant, yelled Ralph Herdman. Well, that stirred things up. All the big kids began to giggle, and all the little kids wanted to know what was so funny, and Mother had to hammer on the floor with a blackboard pointer. That's enough, Ralph, she said, and went on with the story. I don't think it's very nice to say Mary was pregnant, Alice whispered to me. But she was, I pointed out. In a way, though, I agreed with her. It sounded too ordinary. Anybody could be pregnant. Great with child sounded better for Mary. I'm not supposed to talk about people being pregnant. Alice folded her hands in her lap and pinched her lips together. I'd better tell my mother. Tell her what? That your mother is talking about things like that in church. My mother might not want me to be here. I was pretty sure she would do it. She wanted to be Mary, and she was mad at Mother. I knew, too, that she would make it sound worse than it was, and Mrs. Wendelken would get madder than she already was. Mrs. Wendelken didn't even want cats to have kittens or birds to lay eggs, and she wouldn't let Alice play with anybody who had two rabbits. But there wasn't much I could do about it except pinch Alice, which I did. She yelped. And Mother separated us and made me sit beside Imogene Herdman and sent Alice to sit in the middle of the baby angels. I wasn't crazy to sit next to Imogene. After all, I'd spent my whole life staying away from Imogene, but she didn't even notice me. Not much, anyway. Shut up, was all she said. I want to hear her. I couldn't believe it. Among other things, the Herdmans were famous for never sitting still and never paying attention to anyone. Teachers, parents, their own or anybody else's, the truant officer, the police. Yet here they were, eyes glued on my mother and taking in every word. What's that? They would yell whenever they didn't understand the language, and when Mother read about there being no room at the inn, Imogene's jaw dropped, and she sat up in her seat. My God, she said, not even for Jesus? I saw Alice purse her lips together, so I knew that was something else Mrs. Wendelken would hear about, swearing in the church. Well, now, after all, Mother explained, nobody knew the baby was going to turn out to be Jesus. You said Mary knew, Ralph said. Why didn't she tell them? I would have told them, Imogene put in. Boy, would I have told them. What was the matter with Joseph that he didn't tell them? Her pregnant and everything, she grumbled. What was that they laid the baby in, Leroy said. That manger, is that like a bed? Why would they have a bed in the barn? That's just the point, Mother said. They didn't have a bed in the barn, so Mary and Joseph had to use whatever there was. What would you do if you had a new baby and no bed to put the baby in? We put Gladys in a bureau drawer, Imogene volunteered. Well, there you are, Mother said, blinking a little. You didn't have a bed for Gladys, so you had to use something else. Oh, we had a bed, Ralph said, only Ollie was still in it and he wouldn't get out. He didn't like Gladys, he elbowed Ollie. Remember how you didn't like Gladys? I thought that was pretty smart of Ollie not to like Gladys right off the bat. Anyway, Mother said Mary and Joseph use the manger. A manger is a large wooden feeding trough for animals. What were the wadded up clothes? Claude wanted to know. The what? Mother said. You read about it. She wrapped him in wadded up clothes. Swaddling clothes, Mother sighed. Long ago, people used to wrap their babies very tightly in big pieces of material so they couldn't move around. It made the babies feel cozy and comfortable. I thought it probably just made the babies mad. Till then, I didn't know what swaddling clothes were either, and they sounded terrible, so I wasn't too surprised when Imogene got all excited about that. You mean they tied him up and put him in a feed box, she said? Where was the child welfare? The child welfare was always checking up on the Herdmans. I'll bet if the child welfare had ever found Gladys all tied up in a bureau drawer, they would have done something about it. And lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them, Mother went on, and the glory of the Lord shone round about them. And Shazam! Gladys yelled, flinging her arms out and smacking the kid next to her. What? Mother said. Mother never read Amazing Comics. Out of the black night with horrible vengeance, the mighty Marvel... I don't know what you're talking about, Gladys, Mother said. This is the angel of the Lord who comes to the shepherds in the fields. And out of nowhere, right? Gladys said. And the black of night, right? Well, Mother looked unhappy, in a way. So Gladys sat back down, looking very satisfied, as if this was at least one part of the Christmas story that made some sense to her. Now when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, Mother went on reading, behold, there came wise men from the east to Jerusalem, saying, that's you, Leroy, Ralph said, and Claude and Ollie, so pay attention. What does it mean, wise men? Ollie wanted to know. Were they like school teachers? No, dumbbell, Claude said. It means like President of the United States. Mother looked surprised and a little pleased, like she did when Charlie finally learned the timetables up to 5. Why, that's very close, Claude, she said. Actually, they were kings. Well, it's about time, Imogene muttered. Maybe they'd tell the innkeeper where to get off and get the baby out of the barn. They saw the young child with Mary, his mother, and fell down and worshipped him, and presented unto him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. What's that stuff? Leroy wanted to know. Precious oils, Mother said, and fragrant resins. Oil? Imogene hollered. What kind of cheap king hands out oil for a present? You get better presents from the firemen. Sometimes the Herdmans got Christmas presents at the firemen's party, but the Santa Claus always had to feel all around the packages to be sure they weren't getting bows and arrows or dart guns or anything like that. Imogene usually got sewing cards or jigsaw puzzles, and she never liked them, but I guess she figured out they were better than oil. Then we came to King Herod, and the Herdmans have never heard of him either, so Mother had to explain that it was Herod who sent the wise men to find the baby Jesus. Was it him that sent the crummy presents? Ollie wanted to know, and Mother said it was worse than that. He planned to have the baby Jesus put to death. My God, Imogene said. He just got born and already they're out to kill him. The Herdmans wanted to know all about Herod, what he looked like and how rich he was and whether he fought wars with people. He must have been the main king, Claude said, if he could make the other three do what he wanted them to. If I was a king, Leroy said, I wouldn't let some other king push me around. You couldn't help it if he was the main king. I'd go to be king somewhere else. They were really interested in Herod, and I figured they liked him. He was so mean he could have been their ancestor, Herod Herdman. But I was wrong. Who's going to be Herod in this play? Leroy said. We don't show Herod in our pageant, Mother said. And they all got mad. They wanted somebody to be Herod so that they could beat up on him. I couldn't understand the Herdmans. You would have thought the Christmas story came right out of the FBI files. They got so involved in it, wanted a bloody end to Herod, worried about Mary having her baby in a barn, and called the wise men a bunch of dirty spies. And they left the first rehearsal arguing about whether Joseph should have set fire to the inn or just chased the innkeeper into the next county. You're listening to our reading of The Best Christmas Pageant Ever by Barbara Robinson. Chapter 5. When we got home, my father wanted to hear all about it. "Well," Mother said, "just suppose you had never heard the Christmas story and didn't know anything about it, and then somebody told it to you. What would you think?" My father looked at her for a minute or two and then said, "Well, I guess I would think it was pretty disgraceful that they couldn't find any room for a pregnant woman except in the stable." I was amazed. It didn't seem natural for my father to be on the same side as the herdmen's, but then it didn't seem natural for the herdmen's to be on the right side of anything. It would have made more sense for them to be on Herod's side. "Exactly," Mother said. "It was perfectly disgraceful, and I never thought about it much. You hear all about the nice warm stable with all the animals breathing and the sweet-smelling hay, but that doesn't change the fact that they put Mary in a barn." "Now let me tell you," she told my father all about the rehearsal, and when she was through, she said, "It's clear to me that deep down those children have some good instincts after all." My father said he couldn't exactly agree. "According to you," he said, "their chief instinct was to burn Herod alive." "No, their chief instinct was to get Mary and the baby out of the barn. But even so, it was Herod they wanted to do away with, and not Mary or Joseph. They picked out the right villain. That must mean something." "Maybe so," my father looked up from his newspaper. "Is that what finally happened to Herod? What did happen to Herod, anyway?" None of us knew. I never thought much about Herod. He was just a name, somebody in the Bible, Herod the king. But the herdmans went and looked him up. The very next day, Imogene grabbed me at recess. "How do you get a book out of a library?" she said. "You have to get a card." "How do you get a card?" "Well, you have to sign your name." She looked at me for a minute with her eyes all squinched up. "Do you have to sign your own name?" I thought Imogene probably wanted to get one of the dirty books out of the basement, which is where they keep them, but I knew nobody would let her do that. There's this big chain across the stairs to the basement, and Miss Grabner, the librarian, can hear it rattle, no matter where she is in the library, so you don't stand a chance of getting down there. "Sure you have to sign your own name," I said. "They have to know who has the books." I didn't see what difference it made, whether she signed the card with her own name or signed the card Queen Elizabeth. Miss Grabner still wasn't going to let Imogene Hartman take any books out of the public library. I guess she couldn't stop them from using the library, though, because that was where they found out about Herod. They went in that afternoon, all six of them, and told Miss Grabner that they wanted library cards. Usually, when anybody told Miss Grabner that they wanted a library card, she got this big, happy smile on her face and said, "Oh, good. We want all our boys and girls to have library cards." She didn't say that to the herdmans, though. She just asked them why they wanted library cards. "We want to read about Jesus," Imogene said. "Not Jesus," Ralph said. "That king who was out to get Jesus, Herod." Later on, Miss Grabner told my mother that she had been a librarian for 38 years and loved every minute of it because every day brought something new and different. "But now," she said, "I might as well retire." When Imogene Herdman came in and said she wanted to read about Jesus, I knew I'd heard everything there was to hear. At the next rehearsal, Mother started again to separate everyone into angels and shepherds and guests at the inn, but she didn't get very far. The herdmans wanted to rewrite the whole pageant and hang Herod for a finish. They couldn't stand it that he died in bed of old age. "It wasn't just Jesus he was after," Ralph told us. "He killed all kinds of people. He even killed his own wife," Leroy said. "And nothing happened to him," Imogene grumbled. "Well, he died, didn't he?" somebody said. "Maybe he died a horrible death." What did he die of? Ralph shrugged. It didn't say. Flu, I guess. They were so mad about it that I thought they might quit the pageant. But they didn't. Not then or ever. And all the people who kept hoping that the Herdmans would get bored and leave were out of luck. They showed up at rehearsals, right on time, and did just what they were supposed to do. But they were still Herdmans, and there was at least one person who didn't forget that for a minute. One day I saw Alice Wendelken writing something down on a little pad of paper and trying to hide it with her other hand. "It's none of your business," she said. It wasn't any of my business, but it wasn't any of Alice's either. What she wrote was, "Gladys Herdman drinks communion wine." "It isn't wine," I said. "It's grape juice. I don't care what it is. She drinks it. I've seen her 3 times with her mouth all purple. They steal crayons from the Sunday school cupboards, too, and if you shake the happy birthday bank in the kindergarten room, it doesn't make a sound. They stole all the pennies out of that." I was amazed at Alice. I would never think to go and shake the happy birthday bank. "And every time you go in the girls' room," she went on, "the whole air is blue, and Imogene Herdman is sitting there in the Mary costume smoking cigars." Alice wrote all these things down and how many times each thing happened. I don't know why, unless it made her feel good to see in black and white just how awful they were. Since none of the Herdmans had ever gone to church or Sunday school or read the Bible or anything, they didn't know how things were supposed to be. Imogene, for instance, didn't know that Mary was supposed to be acted out in one certain way, sort of quiet and dreamy and out of this world. The way Imogene did it, Mary was a lot like Mrs. Santoro at the pizza parlor. Mrs. Santoro is a big fat lady with a little skinny husband and 9 children, and she yells and hollers and hugs her kids and slaps them around. That's how Imogene's Mary was, loud and bossy. "Get away from the baby," she yelled at Ralph, who was Joseph, and she made the wise men keep their distance. "The wise men want to honor the Christ child," Mother explained for the 10th time. "They don't mean to harm him, for heaven's sake." But the wise men didn't know how things were supposed to be either, and nobody blamed Imogene for shoving them out of the way. You got the feeling that these wise men were going to hustle back to Herod as fast as they could and squeal on the baby out of pure meanness. They thought about it, too. "What if we didn't go home another way?" Leroy demanded. Leroy was Melchior. "What if we went back to the king and told on the baby, where he was and all?" "He would murder Jesus," Ralph said. "Old Herod would murder him." "He would not. That was Imogene with fire in her eye, and since the Herdmans fought one another just as fast as they fought everybody else, Mother had to step in and settle everyone down. I thought about it later, though, and I decided that if Herod, a king, set out to murder Jesus, a carpenter's baby son, he would surely find some way to do it. So when Leroy said, "What if we went back and told on the baby?" it gave you something to think about. No Jesus ever? I don't know whether anybody else got this flash. Alice Wendelken, for one, didn't. "I don't think it's very nice to talk about the baby Jesus being murdered," she said, stitching her lips together and looking sour. That was one more thing to write down on her pad of paper, and one more thing to tell her mother about the Herdmans. Besides the fact that they swore and smoked and stole and all, I think she kept hoping that they would do one great big sinful thing, and her mother would say, "Well, that's that," and get on the telephone and have them thrown out. "Be sure and tell your mother that I can step right in and be Mary if I have to," she told me as we stood in the back row of the angel choir. "And if I'm Mary, we can get the Perkins baby for Jesus." But Mrs. Perkins won't let Imogene Herdman get her hands on him. The Perkins baby would have made a terrific Jesus, and Alice knew it. The way things stood, we didn't have any baby at all, and this really bothered my mother because you couldn't very well have the best Christmas pageant in history with the chief character missing. We had lots of babies offered in the beginning, all the way from Eugene Sloper, who was so new he was still red, up to Junior Caudill, who was almost four, his mother said he could scrunch up. But when all the mothers found out about the Herdmans, they withdrew their babies. Mother had called everybody she knew, trying to scratch up a baby, but the closest she came was Bernice Watrous, who kept foster babies all the time. "I've got a darling little boy right now," Bernice told Mother. "He's 3 months old and so good I hardly know he's in the house." "He's wonderful. Of course, he's Chinese. Does that matter?" "No," Mother said. "It doesn't matter at all." But Bernice's baby got adopted 2 weeks before Christmas, and Bernice said she didn't like to ask to borrow him back right away. So that was that. "Listen," Imogene said. "I'll get us a baby." "How would you do that?" Mother asked. "I'll steal one," Imogene said. "There's always two or three babies in carriages outside the A&P supermarket." "Oh, Imogene, don't be ridiculous," Mother said. "You can't just walk off with somebody's baby, you know." I doubt if Imogene did know that. She walked off with everything else. "We just won't worry any more about a baby," Mother said. "We'll use a baby doll. That'll be better anyway." Imogene looked pleased. "A doll can't bite you," she pointed out, which just went to prove that Herdmans started out mean right from the cradle. Chapter 6. Our last rehearsal happened to be the night before the potluck supper, and when we got there, the kitchen was full of ladies in aprons, counting out dishes and silverware and making applesauce cake for the dessert. "I'm sorry about this," one of the ladies told Mother, "but with so much to do at this time of year, the committee decided to come in this evening and set up the tables and all. I just hope we won't bother you." "Oh, you won't," Mother said. "We won't be in the kitchen. You won't even know we're here." Mother was wrong. Everybody in that end of town knew we were there before the evening was over. "Now, this is going to be a dress rehearsal," Mother told us all, and right away, three or four baby angels began hollering that they forgot their wings. Half the angel choir had forgotten their robes, and Hobie Carmichael said he didn't have any kind of costume. "Wear your father's bathrobe," Charlie told him. "That's what I do." "He doesn't have a bathrobe. What does he hang around the house in? His underwear?" Hobie said. I looked at Alice Wendelken to see if she was going to write that down on her pad of paper, but Alice was standing all by herself in a corner, patting her hair. Her hair was all washed and curled, and her robe was clean and pressed. She had even put Vaseline on her eyelids, so they would shine in the candlelight, and everyone would say, "Who is that lovely girl in the angel choir? Why, isn't she merry?" I guess Alice was afraid to move for fear she might spoil herself. "Don't worry about your wings," Mother said. "The main point of a dress rehearsal isn't the costumes. The main point is to go right straight through without stopping. And that's what we're going to do, just as if we were doing it for the whole congregation. I'm going to sit in the back of the church and be the audience." But it didn't work that way. The baby angels came in at the wrong place and had to go back out again, and a whole gang of shepherds didn't come in at all for fear of Gladys. Imogene couldn't find the baby Jesus doll and wrapped up a great big memorial flower urn in the blanket and then dropped it on Ralph's foot. And half the angel choir sang "Away in the Manger" while the other half sang "O Little Town of Bethlehem." So we had to start over a lot. "I've got the baby here," Imogene barked at the wise men. "Don't touch him. I named him Jesus." "No, no, no," Mother came flying up the aisle. "Now, Imogene, you know you're not supposed to say anything. Nobody says anything in our pageant except the angel of the Lord and the choir singing carols. Mary and Joseph and the wise men make a lovely picture for us to look at while we think about Christmas and what it means." I guess Mother had to say things like that, even though everybody knew it was a big lie. The Herdmans didn't look like anything out of the Bible, more like trick-or-treat. Imogene even had on great big gold earrings, and she wouldn't take them off. "Now, Imogene," Mother said, "you know Mary didn't wear earrings." "I have to wear these," Imogene said. "Why is that?" "I got my ears pierced, and if I don't keep something in them, they'll grow together." "Well, they won't grow together in an hour and a half," Mother said. No, but I better leave them in. Imogene pulled on her earrings, which made you shudder. It was like looking at the pictures in National Geographic of natives with their ears stretched all the way to their shoulders. What did the doctor say about leaving something in them? Mother said. What doctor? Well, who pierced your ears? Gladys, Imogene said. Gladys pierced my ears. That really made you shudder, the thought of Gladys Herdman piercing ears. I thought she'd probably use an ice pick. For the next 6 months, I watched Imogene to see her ears turn black and fall off. All right, Mother said, but we'll try to find something smaller and more appropriate for you to wear in the pageant. Now we'll start again and go right straight through. And I think I ought to tell them what his name is, Imogene said. No, besides, you remember, it wasn't Mary who named the baby. I told you, Ralph whacked Imogene on the back. I named him. Joseph didn't name the baby either, Mother said. God sent an angel to Mary what his name should be. Imogene sniffed. I would have named him Bill. Alice Wendelken sucked in her breath, and I could hear her scratching down on the pad of paper that Imogene Herdman would have called the baby Bill instead of Jesus. What angel was that? Ralph wanted to know. Was that Gladys? No, Mother said. Gladys is the angel who comes to the shepherds with the news. Yeah, Gladys said. Unto you a child is born, she yelled at the shepherds. Unto me? Imogene yelled back at her. Not them, me. I'm the one that had the baby. No, 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 Mother sat down on a front pew. That just means that Jesus belongs to everybody. Unto all of us a child is born. Now, she sighed, let's start again. And why didn't they let Mary name her own baby? Imogene demanded. What did that angel do? Just walk up and say, name him Jesus. Yes, Mother said, because she was in a hurry to get finished. But Alice Wendelken had to open her big mouth. I know what the angel said, Alice piped up. She said, his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. I could have hit her. My God, Imogene said, he'd never get out of the first grade if he had to write all that. There was a big crash at the back of the church as if somebody dropped all the collection plates. But it wasn't the collection plates, it was Mrs. Hopkins, the minister's wife, dropping a whole tray of silverware. I'm sorry, she said, I was just passing by and I thought I'd take a peek. Would you like to sit down and watch the rehearsal? Mother asked. No, no, Mrs. Hopkins couldn't seem to take her eyes off Imogene. I better go check on the applesauce cake. You didn't have to say that, I told Alice. All that about wonderful, everlasting father and all. Why not? Alice said, patting her hair. I thought Imogene wanted to know. By that time, everyone was hot and tired, and most of the baby angels had to go to the bathroom. So Mother said we would take a 5-minute recess. And then we'll start over, she said, looking sort of hopeless, and go right straight through without stopping, won't we? Well, we never did go right straight through. The 5-minute recess was a big mistake because it stretched to 15 minutes, and Imogene spent the whole time smoking cigars in one of the Johns in the ladies' room. Then Mrs. Homer McCarthy went to the ladies' room and opened the door and smelled something funny and saw some smoke, and she ran right to the church office and called the fire department. We were singing Angels We Have Heard on High when what we heard was the fire engine pulling up on the lawn of the church with the siren blaring and the red lights flashing. The firemen hurried in and made us all go outside, and they dragged a big hose in the front door and went looking for a fire to put out. The street was full of baby angels crying and shepherds climbing all over the fire truck and firemen and all the ladies on the potluck committee and neighbors who came to see what was going on and Reverend Hopkins who ran over from the parsonage in his pajamas and his woolly bathrobe. Nobody knew what had happened, including the Herdmans, but I guess they figured that whatever it was, they had done it, so they left. Why in the world did you call the fire department? Mother asked Mrs. McCarthy when she finally heard the whole story. Because the ladies' room was full of thick smoke. It couldn't have been, Mother said. You just got excited. Didn't you know it was cigar smoke? Mrs. McCarthy stared at her. No, I didn't. I don't expect to find cigar smoke in the ladies' room of the church. She whirled around and marched back to the kitchen. But by that time, because while everybody was milling around in the street, all the applesauce cake burned up. Of course, the ladies on the potluck committee were mad about that. Mrs. McCarthy was mad, and Alice said her mother would be good and mad when she heard about it. Most of the baby angels' mothers were mad because they couldn't find out what had happened. And somebody said Mrs. Hopkins was mad because Reverend Hopkins was running around the streets in his pajamas. It turned out to be the one great big sinful thing Alice kept hoping for. Mrs. Wendelken read Alice's notes, got on the telephone that very night, and called up everybody she could think of in the Ladies' Aid and the Women's Society, and she called most of the flower committee and all the Sunday school teachers and Reverend Hopkins. And Reverend Hopkins came to see Mother. "I can't make head or tail of it," he said. "Some people say they set fire to the ladies' room. Some people say they set fire to the kitchen. One lady told me that Imogene threw a flower pot at Ralph. Mrs. Wendelken says all they do is talk about sex and underwear." "That was Hobie Carmichael," Mother said, "talking about underwear, and they didn't set fire to anything. The only fire was in the kitchen, where the potluck committee let their applesauce cake burn up." "Well," Reverend Hopkins looked unhappy, "the whole church is in an uproar. Do you think we should call off the pageant?" "Certainly not," Mother said. By that time, she was mad, too. "Why, it's going to be the best Christmas pageant we've ever had." Of all the lies she told so far, that was the biggest. But you had to admire her. It was like General Custer saying, "Bring on the Indians." "Maybe so," Reverend Hopkins said. "I'm just afraid that no one will come to see it." But he was wrong. Everybody came to see what the Herdmans would do. Chapter 7. On the night of the pageant, we didn't have any supper because Mother forgot to fix it. My father said that was all right. Between Mrs. Armstrong's telephone calls and the pageant rehearsals, he didn't expect supper anymore. "When it's all over," he said, "we'll go someplace and have hamburgers." But Mother said when it was all over, she might want to go someplace and just hide. "We'd never once gone through the whole thing," she said. "I don't know what's going to happen. It may be the first Christmas pageant in history where Joseph and the wise men get in a fight and Mary runs away with the baby." She might be right, I thought, and I wondered what all of us in the angel choir ought to do in case that happened. It would be dumb for us just to stand there singing about the holy infant if Mary had run off with him. But nothing seemed very different at first. There was the usual big mess all over the place, baby angels getting poked in the eye by other baby angels' wings and grumpy shepherds stumbling over their bathrobes. The spotlight swooped back and forth and up and down till it made you sick at your stomach to look at it, and, as usual, whoever was playing the piano pitched Away in a Manger so high we could hardly hear it, let alone sing it. My father says, "Away in a Manger always starts out sounding like a closet full of mice." But everything settled down, and at 7:30, the pageant began. While we sang Away in a Manger, the ushers lit candles all around the church, and the spotlight came on to be the star, so you really had to know the words to Away in a Manger because you couldn't see anything. Not even Alice Wendelken's Vaseline eyelids. After that, we sang two verses of O Little Town of Bethlehem, and then we were supposed to hum some more O Little Town of Bethlehem while Mary and Joseph came in from a side door. Only they didn't come right away. So we hummed and hummed and hummed, which is boring and also very hard, and before long doesn't sound like any song at all, more like an old refrigerator. "I knew something like this would happen," Alice Wendelken whispered to me. "They didn't come at all. We won't have any Mary and Joseph. And now what are we supposed to do?" I guess we would have gone on humming till we all turned blue, but we didn't have to. Ralph and Imogene were there, all right. Only for once they didn't come through the door, pushing each other out of the way. They just stood there for a minute, as if they weren't sure they were in the right place, because of the candles, I guess, and the church being full of people. They looked like the people you see on the 6 o'clock news, refugees sent to wait in some strange, ugly place with all their boxes and sacks around them. It suddenly occurred to me that this was just the way it must have been for the real Holy Family, stuck away in a barn by people who didn't much care what happened to them. They couldn't have been very neat and tidy either, but more like this, Mary and Joseph. Imogene's veil was cockeyed, as usual, and Ralph's hair stuck out all around his ears. Imogene had the baby doll, but she wasn't carrying it the way she was supposed to, cradled in her arms. She had it slung over her shoulder, and before she put it in the manger, she thumped it twice on the back. I heard Alice gasp, and she poked me. "I don't think it's very nice to burp the baby Jesus," she whispered, as if he had colic. Then she poked me again. "Do you suppose he could have had colic?" I said, "I don't know why not," and I didn't. He could have had bad colic, or he had been fussy or maybe hungry like any other baby. After all, that was the whole point of Jesus, that he didn't come down on a cloud like something out of Amazing Comics, but that he was born and lived, a real person. Right away, we had to sing "While Shepherds Watch Their Flocks by Night." And we had to sing very loud because there were more shepherds than there were anything else, and they made so much noise, banging their crooks around like a lot of hockey sticks. Next came Gladys, from behind the angel choir, pushing people out of the way and stepping on everyone's feet. Since Gladys was the only one in the pageant who had anything to say, she made the most of it. "Hey, unto you a child is born," she hollered, as if it was for sure the best news in the world. And all the shepherds trembled, sore afraid of Gladys mainly, but it looked good anyway. Then came three carols about angels. It took that long to get the angels in because they were all primary kids, and they got nervous and cried and forgot where they were supposed to go and bent their wings in the door and things like that. We got a little rest then while the boys sang "We Three Kings of Orient Are," and everybody in the audience shifted around to watch the wise men march up the aisle. "What have they got?" Alice whispered. I didn't know, but whatever it was heavy. Leroy almost dropped it. He didn't have his frankincense jar either, and Claude and Ollie didn't have anything, although they were supposed to bring the gold and the myrrh. I knew this would happen, Alice said for the second time. I bet it's something awful. Like what? Like a burnt offering? You know the Herdmans. Well, they did burn things, but they hadn't burned this yet. It was a ham, and right away I knew where it came from. My father was on the Church Charitable Works Committee. They give away food baskets at Christmas, and this was the Herdman's food basket ham. It still had the ribbon around it saying, "Merry Christmas." I'll bet they stole that, Alice said. They did not. It came from their food basket. And if they want to give away their own ham, I guess they can do it. But even if the Herdmans didn't like ham, that was Alice's next idea, they had never before in their lives given anything away except lumps on the head. So you had to be impressed. Leroy dropped the ham in front of the manger. It looked funny to see a ham there instead of the fancy bath salt jars we always used for the myrrh and the frankincense, and then they went and sat down in the only space that was left. While we sang, "What child is this?" the wise men were supposed to confer among themselves and then leave by a different door, so everyone would understand that they were going home another way. But the Herdmans forgot, or didn't want to, or something, because they didn't confer, and they didn't leave either. They just sat there, and there wasn't anything anyone could do about it. "They're ruining the whole thing," Alice whispered, but they weren't at all. As a matter of fact, it made perfect sense for the wise men to sit down and rest, and I said so. They're supposed to have come a long way. You wouldn't expect them to just show up, hand over the ham, and leave. As for ruining the whole thing, it seemed to me that the Herdmans had improved the pageant a lot, just by doing what came naturally, like burping the baby, for instance, or thinking a ham would make a better present than a lot of perfumed oil. Usually, by the time we got to Silent Night, which was always the last carol, I was fed up with the whole thing and couldn't wait for it to be over. But I didn't feel that way this time. I almost wished for the pageant to go on, with the Herdmans in charge, to see what else they would do that was different. Maybe the wise men would tell Mary about their problem with Herod, and she would tell them to go back and lie their heads off. Or Joseph might go with them and get rid of Herod once and for all. Or Joseph and Mary might ask the wise men to take the Christ child with them, figuring that no one would think to look there. I was so busy planning new ways to save the baby, Jesus, that I missed the beginning of Silent Night. But it was all right because everyone sang Silent Night, including the audience. We sang all the verses, too. And when we got to Son of God, Love's Pure Light, I happened to look at Imogene, and I almost dropped my hymn book on a baby angel. Everyone had been waiting all this time for the Herdmans to do something absolutely unexpected. And sure enough, that was what happened. Imogene Herdman was crying. In the candlelight, her face was all shiny with tears, and she didn't even bother to wipe them away. She just sat there. Awful old Imogene, in her crookedly veil, crying and crying and crying. Well, it was the best Christmas pageant we ever had. Everybody said so, but nobody seemed to know why. When it was over, people stood around the lobby of the church talking about what was different this year. There was something special, everyone said. They couldn't put their finger on what. Mrs. Wendelken said, well, Mary, the mother of Jesus, had a black eye. That was something special, but only what you might expect, she added. She meant that it was the most natural thing in the world for a Herdman to have a black eye. But actually, nobody hit Imogene, and she didn't hit anyone else. Her eye wasn't really black either, just all puffy and swollen. She had walked into the corner of the choir robe cabinet in a kind of daze, as if she had just caught on to the idea of God and the wonder of Christmas. And this was the funny thing about it all. For years I'd thought about the wonder of Christmas and the mystery of Jesus' birth, and never really understood it. But now, because of the Herdmans, it didn't seem so mysterious after all. When Imogene had asked me what the pageant was about, I told her it was about Jesus, but that was just part of it. It was about a new baby and his mother and father, who were in a lot of trouble. No money, no place to go, no doctor, nobody they knew. And then, arriving from the East, like my uncle from New Jersey, some rich friends. But Imogene, I guess, didn't see it that way. Christmas just came over her all at once, like a case of chills and fever. And so she was crying and walking into the furniture. Afterward, there were candy canes and little tiny testaments for everyone and a poinsettia plant for my mother from the whole Sunday school. We put the costumes away and folded up the collapsible manger, and just before we left, my father snuffed out the last of the tall white candles. I guess that's everything, he said as we stood at the back of the church. All over now. It was quite a pageant. Then he looked at my mother. What's that you've got? It's the ham, she said. They wouldn't take it back. They wouldn't take any candy, either, or any of the little Bibles. But Imogene did ask me for a set of the Bible story pictures, and she took out the Mary picture and said it was exactly right. Whatever that means. I think it meant that no matter how she herself was, Imogene liked the idea of the Mary in the picture, all pink and white and pure looking, as if she never washed the dishes or cooked supper or did anything at all except have Jesus on Christmas Eve. But as far as I'm concerned, Mary is always going to look a lot like Imogene Herdman, sort of nervous and bewildered, but ready to clobber anyone who laid a hand on her baby. And the wise men are always going to be Leroy and his brothers, bearing ham. When we came out of the church that night, it was cold and clear with crunchy snow underfoot and bright, bright stars overhead. And I thought about the angel of the Lord, Gladys, with her skinny legs and her dirty sneakers sticking out from under her robe, yelling at all of us everywhere, "Hey, unto you a child is born." You've been listening to our reading of The Best Christmas Pageant Ever by Barbara Robinson. This reading was dedicated to Peter and Betsy Stein and all of their children and grandchildren. The content of this program was intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I'm George Douglas. On behalf of the staff and volunteers of the Triangle Radio Reading Service, we wish you all a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Stay tuned for another great holiday story from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Coming up next, The Fir Tree by Hans Christian Andersen. Content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello again, I'm George Douglas. I hope you'll enjoy my reading of The Fir Tree by Hans Christian Andersen. Out in the forest stood a pretty little fir tree. It had a good place. It could have sunlight. Air there was in plenty. And all around grew many larger comrades, pines as well as firs. But the little fir tree wished ardently to become greater. It did not care for the warm sun and the fresh air. It took no notice of the peasant children who went about talking together when they had come out to look for strawberries and raspberries. Often they came with a whole potful or had strung berries on a straw. Then they would sit down by the little fir tree and say, "How pretty and small that one is!" And the tree did not like to hear that at all. "Oh, if I were only as great a tree as the others," sighed the little fir. "Then I would spread my branches far around and look out from my crown into the wide world. The birds would then build nests in my boughs, and when the wind blew, I could nod just as grandly as the others yonder." He took no pleasure in the sunshine, in the birds, and the red clouds that went sailing over him morning and evening. When it was winter and the snow lay all around, white and sparkling, a hare would often come jumping along and spring right over the little fir. Oh, this made him so angry! But two winters went by, and when the third came, the little tree had grown so tall that the hare was obliged to run around it. "Oh, to grow and become old, that's the only fine thing in the world," thought the tree. In the autumn, woodcutters always came and felled a few of the largest trees. That was done this year, too. And the little fir tree, which was now quite well grown, shuddered with fear, for the great stately trees fell to the ground with a crash, and their branches were cut off so that the trees looked quite naked, long and slender. They could hardly be recognized. But then they were laid upon wagons, and horses dragged them away out of the wood. Where were they going? What destiny awaited them? In the spring, when the swallows and the stork came, the tree asked them, "Do you know where they were taken? Did you not meet them?" The swallows knew nothing about it, but the stork looked thoughtful, nodded his head, and said, "Yes, I think so. I met many new ships when I flew out of Egypt. On the ships were stately masts. I fancy that these were the trees. They smelt like fir. I can assure you they're stately, very stately." "Oh, that I were only big enough to go over to the sea! What kind of thing is this sea? And how does it look?" "It would take too long to explain all that," said the stork, and he went away. "Rejoice in thy youth," said the sunbeams. "Rejoice in thy fresh growth, and in the young life that is within thee." And the wind kissed the tree, and the dew wept tears upon it, but the fir tree did not understand that. When Christmas time approached, quite young trees were felled, sometimes trees which were neither so old nor so large as this fir tree that never rested but always wanted to go away. These young trees, which were almost the most beautiful, kept all their branches. They were put upon wagons, and horses dragged them away out of the wood. "Where are they all going?" asked the fir tree. "They are not greater than I. Indeed, one of them was much smaller. Why do they keep all their branches? Whither are they taken?" "We know that, we know that," chirped the sparrows. "Yonder in the town we looked in at the windows. We know where they go. Oh, they are dressed up in the greatest pomp and splendor that can be imagined. We have looked in at the windows and have perceived that they are planted in the middle of the warm room and adorned with the most beautiful things, gilt apples, honey cakes, playthings, and many hundreds of candles." "And then?" asked the fir tree, and trembled through all its branches. "And then? What happens then?" "Why, we have not seen anything more," said the sparrows, "but it was incomparable. Perhaps I may be destined to tread this glorious path one day," cried the fir tree rejoicingly. "That is even better than traveling across the sea. How painfully I long for it. If it were only Christmas now! Now I am great and grown up, like the rest who were led away last year. Oh, if I were only on the carriage! If I were only in the warm room, among all the pomp and splendor! And then? Yes, then something even better will come, something far more charming, or else why should they adorn me so? There must be something grander, something greater still to come. But what? Oh, I'm suffering, I'm longing, I don't know myself. What is the matter with me?" "Rejoice in us," said air and sunshine. "Rejoice in thy fresh youth here in the woodland." But the fir tree did not rejoice at all, but it grew and grew. Winter and summer it stood there, green, dark green. The people who saw it said, "That's a handsome tree." And at Christmas time it was felled before any one of the others. The axe cut deep into its marrow, and the tree fell to the ground with a sigh. It felt a pain, a sensation of faintness, and could not think at all of happiness, for it was sad at parting from its home, from the place where it had grown up. It knew that it should never again see the dear old companions, the little bushes and flowers all around, perhaps not even the birds. The parting was not at all agreeable. The tree only came to itself when it was unloaded in a yard with the other trees and heard a man say, "This one is perfect. We only want this one." Now two servants came in gay liveries and carried the fir tree into a large, beautiful saloon. All around the walls hung pictures, and by the great stove stood large Chinese vases with lions on the covers. There were rocking chairs, silken sofas, great tables covered with picture books, and toys worth 100 times $100. At least the children said so. And the fir tree was put into a great tub filled with sand. But no one can see that it was a tub, for it was hung round with green cloth and stood on a large many-colored carpet. Oh, how the tree trembled! What was to happen now? The servants and the young ladies also decked it out. On one branch they hung little nets cut out of colored paper. Every net was filled with sweetmeats, golden apples, and walnuts hung down as if they grew there. And more than 100 little candles, red, white, and blue, were fastened to the different boughs. Dolls that looked exactly like real people. The tree had never seen such before, swung upon the foliage, and high on the summit of the tree was affixed a tinsel star. It was splendid, particularly splendid. "This evening," said all, "this evening it will shine." Oh, thought the tree, that it were evening already. Oh, that the lights may be soon lit up. When may that be done? I wonder if trees will come out of the forest to look at me. Will the sparrows fly against the panes? Shall I grow fast here and stand adorned in summer and winter? Yes, he did not guess badly, but he had a complete backache from mere longing, and the backache is just as bad for a tree as the headache is for a person. At last the candles were lighted. What a brilliance! What splendor! The tree trembled so in all its branches that one of the candles set fire to a green twig, and it was scorched. "Heaven preserve us!" cried the young ladies, and they hastily put the fire out. Now the tree might not even tremble. Oh, that was terrible! It was so afraid of setting fire to some of its ornaments, and it was quite bewildered with all the brilliance. And now the folding doors were thrown open, and a number of children rushed in as if they would have overturned the whole tree. The older people followed more deliberately. The little ones stood quite silent, but only for a minute. Then they shouted till the room rang. They danced gleefully around the tree, and one present after another was plucked from it. "What are they about?" thought the tree. "What's going to be done?" And the candles burned down to the twigs, and as they burned down they were extinguished, and then the children received permission to plunder the tree. Oh, they rushed in upon it, so that every branch cracked again. If the tree had not been fastened by the top and by the golden star to the ceiling, it would have fallen down. The children danced about with their pretty toys. No one looked at the tree except one old man, who came up and peeped among the branches, but only to see if a fig or an apple had not been forgotten. "A story! A story!" shouted the children, and they drew a little fat man toward the tree, and he sat down just beneath it. "For then we shall be in the green wood," said he, "and the tree may have the advantage of listening to my tale. But I can only tell one. Will you hear the story of Ivied Avied, or of Clumpy Dumpy, who fell downstairs and still was raised up to honor and married the princess?" "Ivied Avied," cried some. "Clumpy Dumpy," cried others. And there was a great crying and shouting. Only the fir tree was quite silent and thought, "Shall I not be in it? Shall I have nothing to do in it?" But he had been in the evening's amusement and had done what was required of him. And the fat man told about Clumpy Dumpy, who fell downstairs and yet was raised to honor and married the princess. And the children clapped their hands and cried, "Tell another, tell another," for they wanted to hear about Ivied Avied. but they only got the story of Klumpy Dumpy. The fir tree stood quite silent and thoughtful. Never had the birds in the wood told such a story as that. Klumpy Dumpy fell downstairs and yet came to honor and married the princess. Yes, so it happens in the world, thought the fir tree, and believed it must be true, because that was such a nice man who had told it. Well, who can know? Perhaps I shall fall downstairs, too, and marry a princess. And it looked forward with pleasure to being adorned again the next evening with candles and toys, gold and fruit. Tomorrow I shall not tremble, it thought. I will rejoice in all my splendor. Tomorrow I shall hear the story of Klumpy Dumpy again, and perhaps that of Ivied Avied too. And the tree stood all night, quiet and thoughtful. In the morning the servants and the chambermaid came in. Now my splendor will begin afresh, thought the tree. But they dragged him out of the room and upstairs to the garret, and here they put him in a dark corner where no daylight shone. What's the meaning of this? Thought the tree. What am I to do here? What is to happen? And he leaned against the wall and thought and thought. And he had time enough, for days and nights went by and nobody came up, and when at length someone came, it was only to put some great boxes in a corner. Now the tree stood quite hidden away, and the supposition was that it was quite forgotten. Now it's winter outside, thought the tree. The earth is hard and covered with snow, and people cannot plant me. Therefore, I suppose I'm to be sheltered here until spring comes. How considerate that is! How good people are! If it were only not so dark in here and so terribly solitary, not even a little hare. That was pretty out there in the wood, when the snow lay thick and the hare sprang past, yes, even when he jumped over me. But then I did not like it. It is terribly lonely up here. Peep, peep, said a little mouse, and crept forward. And then came another little one. They smelt at the fir tree, and then slipped among the branches. It's horribly cold, said the two little mice, or else it would be comfortable here. Don't you think so, you old fir tree? I'm not old at all, said the fir tree. There are many much older than I. Where do you come from? Asked the mice. And what do you know? They were dreadfully inquisitive. Tell us about the most beautiful spot on earth. Have you been there? Have you been in the storeroom where the cheeses lie on the shelves and hams hang from the ceiling? Where one dances on tallow candles and goes in thin and comes out fat? I don't know that, replied the tree, but I know the wood where the sun shines and where the birds sing. And then it told all about its youth. The little mice had never heard anything of the kind, and they listened and said, "What a number of things you have seen! How happy you must have been!" I, said the fir tree, and it thought about what it had told. Yes, those were really quite happy times. But then he told of the Christmas Eve when he had been hung with sweetmeats and candles. Oh, said the little mice, how happy you have been, you old fir tree. I'm not old at all, said the tree. I only came out of the wood this winter. I'm only rather backward in my growth. What splendid stories you can tell, said the little mice. And the next night they came with four other little mice to hear what the tree had to relate. And the more it said, the more clearly did it remember everything and thought, those were quite merry days. But they may come again. Klumpy Dumpy fell downstairs, and yet he married the princess. Perhaps I may marry a princess too. And then the fir tree thought of a pretty little birch tree that grew out in the forest. For the fir tree, that birch, was a real princess. Who's Klumpy Dumpy? Asked the little mice. And then the fir tree told the whole story. It could remember every single word, and the little mice were ready to leap to the very top of the tree with pleasure. Next night a great many more mice came, and on Sunday even two rats appeared. But these thought the story was not pretty, and the little mice were sorry for that, for now they also did not like it so much as before. "Do you only know one story?" asked the rats. "Only that one," replied the tree. "I heard it on the happiest evening of my life. I did not think then how happy I was." It's a very miserable story. Don't you know any about bacon and tallow candles, a storeroom story? "No," said the tree. "Then we'd really rather not hear you," said the rats. And they went back to their own people. The little mice at last stayed away also. And then the tree sighed and said, "It was very nice when they sat around me, the merry little mice, and listened when I spoke to them. Now that's past, too. But I shall remember to be pleased when they take me out." But when did that happen? Why, it was one morning that people came and rummaged in the garret. The boxes were put away and the tree brought out. They certainly threw him rather roughly on the floor, but a servant dragged him away at once to the stairs where the daylight shone. "Now life is beginning again," thought the tree. It felt the fresh air and the first sunbeams, and now it was out in the courtyard. Everything passed so quickly that the tree quite forgot to look at itself. There was so much to look at all around. The courtyard was close to a garden, and here everything was blooming. The roses hung fresh and fragrant over the little paling. The linden trees were in blossom, and the swallows cried, "Quinswit, Quinswit, my husband's come." But it was not the fir tree that they meant. "Now I shall live," said the tree rejoicingly, and spread its branches far out. But alas, they were all withered and yellow, and the tree lay in the corner among nettles and weeds. The tinsel star was still upon it and shone in the bright sunshine. In the courtyard were playing a couple of the merry children who had danced round the tree at Christmas time and had rejoiced over it. One of the youngest ran up and tore off the golden star. "Look what is sticking to the ugly old fir tree," said the child, and he trod upon the branches till they cracked again under his boots. And the tree looked at all the blooming flowers and the splendor of the garden, and then looked at itself, and wished it had remained in the dark corner of the garret. It thought of its fresh youth in the wood, of the merry Christmas Eve, and of the little mice which had listened so pleasantly to the story of Klumpy Dumpy. "Past, past," said the old tree. "Had I but rejoiced when I could have done so. Past, past." And the servant came and chopped the tree into little pieces. A whole bundle lay there. It blazed brightly under the great brewing copper, and it sighed deeply. And each sigh was like a little shot. And the children who were at play there ran up and seated themselves at the fire, looked into it, and cried, "Puff! Puff!" But at each explosion, which was a deep sigh, the tree thought of a summer day in the woods, or of a winter night there, when the stars beamed. He thought of Christmas Eve and of Klumpy Dumpy, the only story he had ever heard or knew how to tell. And then the tree was burned. The boys played in the garden, and the youngest had on his breast a golden star, which the tree had worn on its happiest evening. Now that was past, and the tree's life was past, and the story is past, too. Past, past. And that's the way with all stories. That was The Fir Tree by Hans Christian Andersen. I'm your reader, George Douglas. On behalf of all of us here at the Triangle Radio Reading Service, we wish you and your family a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is available as a podcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. Click on the best Christmas pageant ever. Goodbye.